Hi everyone, I'm Les.
And I'm Ashley.
And you're listening to Anthropotamus, where we explore some of your favorite anthropology topics.
Hey everyone, welcome to our latest episode of Anthropotamus. We're here with Jesse Mueller, student, PhD student at the University of Nevada, Reno. He's going to be talking with us today about his research, a continental scale comparison of social networks and early Holocene technology. But before we get into that, Jackson, thank you for being on the show with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
But before we go into your research, tell us about your background, because you have several years' experience in archaeology, as well as your educational background.
Sure. I kind of entered academia a little later than a lot of other of your interviewees, I think. I got my bachelor's at UNR in Reno, about 15 years ago, I think it's been, and went immediately into the master's program in Missoula. And after that, I worked in contract archaeology for about 15 years before deciding to make the switch into the program at UNR again. I've been able to fall into a lot of positions where I was fortunate enough to work across the country on a variety of different types of projects. And so I am excited to be returning to academia and embarking on this new research project.
Can you go in a little further on your experience in CRM? Because we don't have a lot of individuals who come on who have as much experience in that as you do.
Sure. CRM is cultural resource management. It's kind of the private sector version of archaeology that people have to conduct in order to do environmental clearance for projects on federal land or federally funded projects, those sorts of things. I think about 90% of archaeology is probably done in the private sector in that way. And so there's a lot of opportunity for travel, seeing different things. You don't get to choose your research project that way, unfortunately. It's more of a type of thing where they call you up and they say, hey, we have to clear an area of land, and you go and you look at whatever you find and then report it to the state. I've been doing that for quite a while in a variety of positions. I started out as a field tech. We call them shovel bums in the industry, and eventually became a crew chief and then field supervisor. And right before I went back to school, I was permitted as a principal investigator throughout the country. That's the person who is really in charge of submitting the project, making sure it all reads right, and sort of accounts for the archaeology that we find.
So with your research, you're looking at relationships between communities with the Great Basin and plains, focusing on square-based and projectile points. I mean, what I liked about this is we go out when we're in the field, we're like, oh, it's another projectile point. And we often, because especially in CRM, our goal is to gather and maybe return items to tribal members. And we don't always get to take the time to analyze our finds. So I like that in your research paper, we're kind of putting the people back into thinking about the people who these belong to and the relationships they would have had with one another. So go ahead and tell our listeners, how did you even start thinking about just even composing this project?
Sure. You're absolutely right. The things that we find are really just more of a jumping off point into trying to figure out the lives of people in the past. And that can get really tricky the farther back in time you go. So I'm looking at groups that lived during the early Holocene. That's about 11,500 to 8,000 years ago. It can be really difficult. And I noticed I was on a private contracted archaeology job one day, and we found a whole bunch of these projectile points. They could be dart points, kind of like giant arrows almost, or they could have been spear points. It was hard to tell, but what we noticed was there were a whole bunch in one specific area, and we took them and we analyzed them for to kind of see where they came from originally, from the, you know, geologically. And we noticed that they were coming almost overwhelmingly from the north, from the Snake River Plains. Now, this is interesting because a lot of archaeologists think of the Great Basin in Nevada as being kind of isolated, but that's not true. That's clearly kind of a simplistic way of looking at it. And I just got fascinated with the idea of people coming into this area from very different locations and making a living there.
Traditionally speaking, we tend to think of lithics as something that, well, it can only really, you'll find stone tools, you know, scattered across large areas, but that's usually because humans have carried them, right? And we use that a lot of times as markers of migration and other things like that. And it looks like in this project, you're proposing that the groups had contact specifically and sort of exchanged some cultural practices on how to make those lithics. What led you to think that they may have exchanged those practices rather than these being groups that migrated in and left tools behind?
That's a really good question, Les. I guess the simple answer is we don't know at this point. That's one of the questions that we kind of want to answer. Objects and technology can travel through regions in a lot of different ways. And whether or not people learned from these Eastern groups that moved west into the Great Basin or south from the Snake River Plains, or they were carrying these objects, it could have been sort of a large scale migration. Right now, we don't really know which one is more likely. That's one of the things that I'm really interested in exploring in the near future. What we think we can do is sort of trace the travel of those types of technologies and see how they sync up with the expansion of bison in the Great Basin. The idea being that if there are Great Plains groups moving along with bison herds into our area or the Nevada area, that's a pretty clear indicator that they were groups back then were following these bison hunters and sort of moving into these areas where you have a very different style of living. It's called the Western Stem Tradition. Those guys typically lived along marshes, lake edges. But we see something very different happening with the more Eastern point styles.
This muting and unmuting is throwing me off. So what if you take on a couple of different types of analysis in your research, one being XRF analysis. Could you describe to our listeners who don't know what that is and the importance of identifying where obsidian has been sourced from?
Sure. XRF is short for X-ray fluorescence. It's a way that we scan these objects, usually volcanic stone like obsidian or basalt. And those stones have tiny trace amounts of elements that are only found in certain areas. So if you can pick up on a signature of rubidium and a whole host of other elements that I can barely pronounce, you can tell that they came from a certain place. Like, oh, this stone came from Northeast Oregon, or this stone came from Southern Nevada. And since the only way for those stones to travel is through humans, that's a really good measure of how people are traveling across the landscape. Now, teasing that out between, now figuring out which, trying to see whether or not those stones are moving through trade or actually through human movement is another story.
So I was looking at part of the your paper here, and it looks like you had some possible evidence that might indicate that the some of the stone tools that you found in the Great Basin area may have been imperfect copies Something I was a little unclear about that. Can you explore that a little bit?
Sure. This is actually a project that a young scholar named Amanda Hartman took on a number of years ago. She was really interested in sort of the styles of the projectile points that were being made. And she took on this big project where she measured and, you know, weighed and took all these different metrics of these points, and she concluded that they're pretty much the same in the Great Plains as they are in the Great Basin. But there's a lot of variety. All of these stone tools are specifically made objects. There's never going to be one that's exactly like the other. It's not like they're cranking them out like tin cans. Someone has to sit and make these every time you want one. And she found that although they're really, really similar and probably being made for the same purposes, there's a lot more variety in the Great Basin than there is in the Great Plains. That could be partially due to people getting away from these core groups of bison hunters and sort of coming up with their own styles, their own take on these sorts of points. That is a natural consequence of people just moving away.
It looks like there has been a little bit of study on the subject. Some people have noted the similarities between the points found in this area and the points found in... What opposition do you expect to find when you present your research, or what reasons do you think people may have overlooked a connection in the past?
That's a really good question, Les. I think the main oppositions are going to be from scholars who have a vested interest in sort of maintaining the idea that the Great Basin is a unique technological area. We do have a lot of evidence that we're unique in that we have these different styles of points and technologies, crescents and stem points, those sorts of things. To suggest that some of these didn't originate here can be frightening and open up a whole new academic can of worms. But I think that demonstrating the relationships and the complications of how people move back and forth over really, really long landscape, I think it's exciting to sort of look at the complicated way in which people moved across long distances, including across continents. That doesn't diminish the achievements that people here had. It just makes our understanding of the past a lot richer.
When you go in front of your committee, is there like one question you're like, oh God, I hope they don't ask me this?
Yeah, one of the questions that I struggle with, and I think it's true for most people who do it, anything really niche, is you get asked the question like, why should anyone care about this? And I don't know how to answer that really. There are a lot of different ways to, you know, a lot of different reasons to care about the past. And the most important, I think, is that we're telling a story, we're building a narrative of the history of our continent. And so that in and of itself, I think, is really interesting. It's not just, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up reading these books, and they would depict Native Americans and tribal communities as sort of bouncing around these empty landscapes and killing animals with sticks and rocks, and that was it. But that's so simplistic and doesn't really give those past groups enough credit for, you know, how complicated their lives really were. And to factor in groups moving along with animal herds and getting to know people that were already there, fleshing out these huge communities that existed back then, I think is very, very exciting.
What I think would be interesting if tribes would allow, which I know most would not, is if we were able to collect DNA samples from different remains throughout the U.S. and try to find a pattern of genetic flow And I think that would really help in seeing migration or just relationships when comparing to shared cultures. But that's something that's probably not going to happen. And I don't blame them for us not wanting us to, you know, do a destructive analysis on their ancestors. But it would be interesting to see the results.
Yeah, that would be, speaking as a scientist, I think that would be an amazing project. The problem is you get back into this early Holocene time period, you have almost no bodies to analyze. Even if you could, you're looking at a data set of about 3. So that would be really tricky. Plus the really painful process of destroying human remains is something that we're really trying to avoid. And I think I think tribal members who have opposed that have a pretty good reason for doing so. What's nice about looking at stone tools through XRF is we have a lot of stone tools and it's non-destructive. You can find a spear point or a flake or something made out of obsidian. You zap it with your laser gun and that's it. You don't have to cut chunks off of it or anything like that.
I like the term zap it with your laser gun. That's amazing. It's something that you don't hear enough in any field, but the fact that it's a part of this one makes me very happy inside.
Yeah, there's not enough laser guns in the sciences, I think. So if you can get a hold of one, I highly recommend using it, if not for just telling people that you have a laser gun.
Yeah, I've got a new career goal.
Unless you have any other questions before I start moving on.
No, you know what? I think I'm mostly good. I'm going to be interested to see more on this project, though, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's something that I'm very excited about. One of the things that sort of this project is a bit of a marriage in between contract archaeology and academic archaeology. So in Nevada, especially, we've had a lot of development, mining, geothermal power lines, those sorts of things. And so those projects generate a ton of data, reports, excavations, those sorts of things. And a lot of that just ends up going into a cabinet at the federal office and no one ever sees it again. What I'm very excited about doing is taking that data that's been generated for the last 50 years and actually making more use of it than I think than has been done in the past. The goals of the original archaeological laws back in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, were to act as stewards of this information that we have collectively on federal land. It hasn't worked out that way as much as I think we would have hoped. And so maybe this is a step towards that.
I like that idea. I think it's, I think you're absolutely right. We see plenty of academic information coming out of universities, and a lot of that is because that's part of their point. But these laws in particular, they're wonderful for providing work, but what are we doing with that information? And this is a great step in the direction of really getting that out there and making use of it.
Well, thank you. I'm not the only one to do these sorts of things. There are other folks that have taken this on. Our former BLM state archaeologist Brian Hockett has been really good about kind of pushing the envelope and using these sorts of data sets to publish. But it hasn't happened as often as I think it should. There's always a section when you apply for a permit where you have to write what are you going to do with this information? Where is this going to go? And you always, or a lot of people, usually write like, oh, this data will be published for scholarly review in academic journals. And it just rarely happens. A lot of us just don't have the time to do it.
I was, you know, the SEA just wrapped up and sitting in a lot of those talks. It's quite admirable that you see Far Western get involved in a lot of these projects as a CRM company, like every other, you know, talk I went to was like, thank you, Far Western, for such and such and such. And it's like, wow, I wish we had more CRM companies who get so involved with research. But, you know, it's a lot going on and it doesn't really happen. And it, you know, it's not really what, you know, when you go into archaeology, I think a lot of us kind of hope that we could do that research that Far Western kind of emphasizes on, but it's just not reality right now.
Yeah, when you're chasing contracts, that usually takes up a lot of your time. Far Western has done some fantastic work. They put out a lot of the occasional papers that U of Utah publishes. They do a lot of documentary work and really do a fantastic job of getting that information out to the public in a way that a lot of other companies don't. So I've always been really impressed with what they generate.
So Jackson, what's your next step in this research you have going on? How much longer do you even have left? Like, you've been there for a few years now also.
Yeah, well, it's I'm actually in my second year of the PhD program. I started a little bit earlier. I took classes for fun before I was actually accepted, snuck in through the back door. The next step is going to all these federal land management offices throughout Nevada, starting with Nevada, and going through all the reports and seeing where these objects are that I can track down physically on the ground and go and with my laser gun and, you know, analyze them. There's a lot of data that we have. When you do an archaeological survey, you have a list of what we call isolates. It's like one artifact by itself out in the middle of nowhere. It's not really associated with a site or anything that you can interpret at greater detail. But those isolate tables still have a lot of information, especially with spear points and projectile points, the kind that I'm looking at. So tracking a lot of those down is a way to use the information that we already have in a way that I don't think has been done yet, to my knowledge. So the next step, Ashley, it's driving out to Battle Mountain, to Winnemucca, Denio, and those sorts of places, and sort of just finding them on the ground and looking at them and seeing where they came from.
This is a little bit unrelated, but I actually drove through Battle Mountain last year. Best town name I've ever found. It's great. Actually, I had another question. So it occurs to me that working from data sets that were pre-collected might be challenging. In what way has it been challenging to use those data sets rather than doing the archaeology on the ground yourself?
That's a really good question. I think the challenging part is taking other people at their word. There's a lot of archaeologists who have a different view of what certain technology is. So I could look at a spear point and see one thing. Somebody else could look at the same spear point and see something completely different. At least we look at different technological elements of these things. And so there's a lot of interpretation that goes along with that. And if you just go by the tables that are in past reports that say, oh, this is what this is, and there's no pictures or anything, that can be challenging because you don't have any way to verify that. Not that people in the past did a bad job or anything, but you do want to be consistent, and that can be more challenging than doing all the data collection yourself. The other challenge is going out to relocate sites that haven't been collected or mitigated, which means they get excavated or picked up. These projects a lot of times are done to see what's there before the whole area gets destroyed through a mine or a road goes in. And so a lot of these sites that are recorded might not even exist anymore. And if it wasn't important, if it wasn't just one isolated spear point out in the middle of nowhere, that's not going to get collected. And so we lose that information.
I was piggybacking on Alessa's question. I was wondering, and you discussed earlier about copies. And I know for me right now, the project I'm on is, you know, we can't take photos of any diagnostics, and you know, it's going to the tribe. The tribe's going to do their ceremony and bury it afterwards. So all we have are sketches. So how? And I'm not an artist. Okay, I can sketch well enough to where you can tell what it is. You can probably type it. But if you're relying on sketches, how reliable is it to tell whether or not it's a copy? Or are you just trusting that it's not a copy?
Well, even if it is a copy, if it's the same style, that tells us something about how that technology got into this area. Something I think is really just as interesting as if it came directly from a place outside of our area. I focus mostly on Nevada because that's where my area of expertise is. That's where I hold the permits. And in Nevada, we are fortunate to be able to photograph a lot of what we find. Those abilities depend a lot on the perspective of stakeholders, in most cases, tribes. Doesn't always have to be tribes, but those are the folks who hold the biggest sway on a lot of our permits. And we are able to take measurements and photographs in most cases. If there are artifacts associated with burials or human remains or those sorts of things, that's a little bit different. But we're not limited by a lot of the factors that come up in different regions like California. If you find in reports some sketches, a lot of the older archaeologists are very good at that sort of thing. I became an archaeologist kind of at the tail end of sketching artifacts. And I've never really got very good at it. But it takes a lot of practice, but you can tell when somebody sketches an artifact if they know what they're doing and really rely on their, you can rely on what they see and what they communicate through those sketch pieces.
So what you're saying is that while it may not be, you know, essential, it's a very good skill to have for an upcoming archaeologist to learn how to sketch properly.
Yeah, I would recommend anybody who is taking archaeology classes or wants to go into this field, take a couple of illustration classes. It's not, you're probably not going to sketch artifacts in the field as much as you used to, but you are going to pay attention more to items if you are drawing them. Yeah, you have to interpret them and you have to know what you're looking at if you want to translate that from, you know, to ink and paper. I took an illustration class a long time ago and I was just amazed at how much better I got at reading artifacts just because I had to look at them. I had to think about how they were made in order to describe how they looked now.
Yeah, I'm always trying to, when I'm sketching, I'm trying to create the lines and the flakes that have come off on the sides. I'm like, these have got to be important, even though I'm not a rock person. But I'm always thinking, too, if I have some like coworkers with sketches instead, they don't know. I don't think they pay as much attention to those where things have broken off. So I'm like, I'm going to just sit myself. I don't know. I don't know how important the sketch or like if anybody's even going to look at it. I don't know. But yeah. Unless you have any other questions before we start wrapping up.
No. I think that's all I've got for now. I'll probably, like, if you keep going on, I'm definitely going to have another question because everything you say seems to trigger something. No, for now, I think that's good. I would love to talk to you about this again when there's a little more research or a little more further down in the project, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm working on a pretty small data set right now. The projects you've seen that I sent you earlier, Les, are sort of a pilot project of a greater campaign. But I'm really interested in tracking like huge movements of people across the landscape and seeing how that fits in with the way people moved before they came over and afterwards.
That's all you got, Les, for now. We can wrap it up. Yeah. Okay. All right, Jackson, thank you again for coming on the show. For our listeners, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, CastBox, iTunes, Audible, and you can watch this Zoom recording on YouTube. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Anthropotamus. Bye.
Thank you all for listening. Distribution of Anthropotamus is in collaboration with the American Anthropological Association. Please continue to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Anthropotamus for our latest episodes, show notes, and book discussion schedule.